And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week, we launched the first in our series of weekly Earth Summits, bringing you the perspectives of the world's leading scientists, advocates, and leaders as they speak out each week to unite the efforts to save life on Earth. At no time in history has the challenge been so direct and the opportunity so commanding to form a new global Earth network to redirect our future to a new sustainable world order. We invite you along on this historic exploration of possibilities when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Beginning with this show, the Wild Side News adds a new feature, the Weekly Earth Summit, and changes its format slightly to provide a most concise and effective weekly update on what's happening in the realms of nature and the environment. The Weekly Earth Summit will open all shows from now on and bring you a concise commentary by our panel of regular contributors, including Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, President of the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment, and Advisor to the World Bank, United Nations Foundation, and the Smithsonian, Dr. Charles Kennell, recent Director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a member of the Pew Commission on the Oceans, Dave Foreman, author, iconoclast, and earth advocate, and founder of the Rewilding Institute, Dr. Matthew Sleeth, a leading spokesman for the creation care movement of the faith-based communities and author of Serve God, Save the Planet, Dr. Robin Moore with Conservation International, Dr. Mark Beckhoff, preeminent animal behaviorist, author, and co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and student advocates Ben Lowe and Emma Sleeth and others from our nation's college campuses. Besides the Weekly Earth Summit that opens each show, we will then move on in segment two to cover the current nature news and then focus in on our special topic. Today, we talk with people along the West Coast who are struggling with the sudden illness and death of hundreds of seabirds, seals, and whales as a result of a particularly lethal strain of deadly algae. We hope these programming changes will make the Wild Side News more responsive to your needs as a committed nature advocate. And so now, without further fanfare, we introduce the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Today, our regular panelists provide an overview of thought on issues relevant to us all. So now we open today's summit with Dr. Charles Kennell, recent director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography.
One of the major events celebrating the centennial year of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, 2003, was a reunion and symposium celebrating the 50th anniversary of Scripps's great mid-pack expedition and its predecessor, Capricorn. I'm afraid that my opening remarks may have dismayed the veterans who were gathered there, for I said that their great research crews brought the age of European exploration that started with Prince Henry the Navigator to a definitive end after 500 years. To borrow a thought that John Maynard Keynes had applied to his Cambridge predecessor, Isaac Newton, they were the last generation to look upon the world through the eyes of the ancients. The fact that oceanographers had become involved with hydrogen bomb tests already presaged that the world to come was to be very different, and a few, especially Roger Revelle, saw where things were going. From our present vantage point in time, when every square meter of Earth has been surveyed by satellite and can be Googled at will, the challenge is no longer to discover what is there, but to understand how the many complex parts of the Earth system interact. The challenge is not to push outwards, but to connect together. We now know what these great pioneers did not. Our civilization faces an entirely new situation. Humans have always altered their environment to suit their needs, but their impact only reached global proportions in the last 50 years. New words have entered public discourse. Biodiversity decline, habitat fragmentation, deforestation, increasing drought, desertification, ozone hole, atmospheric brown cloud, retreating glaciers, disappearing Arctic ice, sea level rise, and the granddaddy of them all, global warming. The state of nature, if it ever existed, has disappeared. And the world we study today will be different tomorrow because of what we humans do. We also know, as never before, that earth science has an essential role to play in preserving our civilization and the planet that supports it so lavishly.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. Next, we hear from Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club.
America's heartland took a giant step forward towards licking global warming. Kansas City Power and Light entered into a legally binding settlement with the Sierra Club to offset all 100% of the emissions of carbon dioxide that will come from a new coal plant KCP&L is constructing. The utility will also quadruple its planned investment in renewables like wind and solar. It's going to jointly work with the Sierra Club to change the rules for all public utilities in Kansas and Missouri to ensure that by 2020, KCP&L will have reduced its emissions of carbon dioxide by 20%. This agreement breaks fundamentally new ground. It raises the bar for all electrical utilities. No coal-based utility previously had made these kinds of legally enforceable commitments. The agreement sends a strong signal that while this may not be the end of the coal rush, nor even the beginning of the end, it might, in Winston Churchill's famous phrase, be the end of the beginning. The comprehensive nature of the settlement, a drastic limit on new coal construction, full offset of carbon dioxide, the cleanup of Kansas City Power and Light's existing power plants in Kansas City, including 90% of the mercury, dramatic investments in renewables and efficiency, and a partnership with the Sierra Club to lay the framework for an even cleaner and more economic future for these two states, make this a watershed. I was talking with Michael Chesser, the CEO of the company, just before we inked the deal. He told me, once we started talking, we realized we really did have common goals. He said he looked forward to working with the Sierra Club to persuade state government in Kansas and Missouri to make it legally possible for his power company to meet all of its electricity needs with efficiency and renewables and avoid further coal investments completely. This agreement is a win for our climate, for the environment, and for the residents of the Kansas City area. It's just the latest sign that smart energy solutions such as wind power and energy efficiency are gathering momentum and popularity because they make economic sense. Time to deal with global warming is indeed short, but America is moving. It may be a much earlier spring thaw than we expected for the new energy economy, and a good thing, too.
Thank you, Carl. Dr. Matthew Sleeth adds some inspiring words about his faith and our future.
There are three ways people approach issues. As regards the environment, some focus on its history, others study the actual problem, and some work on the solution. My training in emergency medicine taught me to focus on the latter when time is of the essence. What has gotten us into our precarious position is not a lack of science, engineering, or politics. It is a lack of love. Yet this four-letter word and the power it holds is absent from most environmental rhetoric. Love isn't measurable. It can't be patented or traded on Wall Street. Yet it is why we marry, have children, and sacrifice. In its absence, we hoard, act selfishly, and go to war. I come to the environmental table because of my faith. I love the Creator, so I must love what the Creator created. When asked how one gets to heaven, Jesus responded that we must love our God and our neighbor as ourselves. Nowhere are the qualities and attributes of love better described than in the book of Corinthians. And I quote, "Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous, boastful, proud, or rude. Love does not demand its own way. Love is not irritable, and it keeps no record of when it has been wronged. It is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance." End quote. Science, politics, and engineering may be powerful and necessary parts of the environmental fix, yet they will ultimately fail if we do not take seriously the need to love one another.
His recent book, Serve God, Save the Planet, expands on his perspective. We're hearing a lot these days about threats to the very fabric of life on Earth. We now hear from panelists who wish to focus on this important topic. We begin with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who is given credit for coining the term biodiversity and directs the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment.
I think the single most riveting environmental change in my entire career is the discovery a couple of years ago that the oceans have becoming acid, literally 30% more acid than in pre-industrial times. We've heard of acid lakes, we've heard of acid rain, but now we have acid oceans. And one might ask, what does that mean? Well, it turns out that there is this enormous number of species in the oceans that build skeletons from calcium carbonate. And that depends on an equilibrium, which is dependent on pH and how acid or alkaline the oceans are. And so if the trends continue, this is all driven by elevated CO2 in the atmosphere, basically some of which becomes carbonic acid. If those trends continue, you will reach points at which corals and mollusks and tiny little planktonic organisms that build shells of calcium carbonate could literally not only have trouble making their shells could dissolve while they're alive.
Adding to Dr. Lovejoy's concerns, we now hear from Dr. Robin Moore, who is an amphibian conservation officer with the Amphibian Specialist Group and works with Conservation International to restore and maintain viable animal populations around the world.
Amphibians have been around on Earth virtually unchanged for over 100 million years. This is far longer than we have. They're survivors. It's alarming, therefore, that we're now experiencing a mass extinction crisis within this entire class of animals. As a direct or indirect result of human actions, almost a third of all amphibian species are currently threatened with extinction. It's too late for many of these species, which have already gone, but we still have a chance to do something to halt this alarming trend and to save many of the species that are on the brink of extinction. The amphibian extinction crisis is a symptom of a much larger problem that threatens the very ecosystems that we depend on for clean water, clean air, and food. These ecosystems that we often take for granted may be telling us something, and we need to finally sit up and pay attention. We risk going beyond the point of no return if we do not respond quickly. Amphibians are often cited as early warning systems. They provide an indication of the health of an ecosystem. Their permeable skins take in everything that's in the environment. They're associated with both land and water. They typically lay unprotected eggs and therefore are exposed to the elements. They're very susceptible to subtle changes in the environment, and as such, they act as barometers of ecosystem health. If we lose the amphibians, we can expect a domino effect. We have no idea what will be affected next, whether it will be birds or mammals, including humans. So why should we really care if we lose frogs? Try to imagine a forest that was once alive with the sounds of frog calls and is now completely silent. It's hard for us to imagine this until it really happens. Many frogs are very closely associated with the fresh water that we rely on. They provide an indicator of a healthy, clean water supply. Feeding on invertebrates, they control the number of insects that are crop pests and vectors for disease such as malaria and dengue fever. If frogs disappear from the food web, the domino effects will be massive. The amphibian extinction crisis is happening before our very eyes and is sending us a signal. The realization has prompted a response from the global community. Next week, I will talk about what the Amphibian Specialist Group of the World Conservation Union are doing to tackle the problem. In subsequent weeks, I will focus on individual species and individual case studies to give an overview of the threats that are facing amphibians on a case-by-case basis.
The efforts to appreciate the value of our animal species often begins in our own backyard. We now hear from Dr. Mark Beckhoff, Professor Emeritus at Colorado State University of Boulder, whose exploration of the complex emotional lives of animals has earned him a Guggenheim Fellowship. He helps us open our perceptions to the animals around us.
I think one of the reasons they try to figure out cats and dogs, focusing a lot on their differences, is because dogs have evolved from social wolves, and cats have basically evolved, you know, from more solitary species. And so, you know, there's no doubt that cats, on average, seem to be more loners than do dogs. You know, people once again have looked at the play behavior of these animals. They've looked at the way in which they mark out their territories. And so, you know, the basic bottom line is that, on average, dogs are more social, and on average, cats are less social. But what's fascinating is that cats really are social. A German ethologist named Paul Lehausen years ago pointed out that there's really no such thing as a solitary animal. And, of course, there are solitary animals, but what he meant was that even though cats are more solitary than dogs, they do scent mark and they deposit urine all over the place and maybe some glandular substances. Other cats come across them and they change their ways. They change their direction of travel, for example. So what's really exciting is that, in fact, there is social regulation among cats, but sometimes you only see one cat doing it, whereas in the dogs and wolves and other social carnivores, you actually see two or more animals somehow negotiating space. So I find that to be really fascinating.
We will hear from Dr. Beckhoff each week here at the Weekly Earth Summit. Now, a youthful perspective from college student and nature advocate, Ben Lowe.
You've probably noticed that the environment has a new advocate. It's the evangelical Christian. Actually, this really isn't new. The most recent evangelical concern for the environment started back in the 1970s and is commonly referred to as creation care. For far too long, however, creation care was treated as a fringe movement within the church. This is changing, and it's changing quickly. What we're now seeing is a new wave of creation care awareness and action sweeping through the evangelical community. This is especially true within my generation. Today's evangelical youth and young adults are moving beyond our old truncated mission of focusing on a narrow list of issues. As the president of New York Divinity School, Paul DeVries, recently said in an interview on CNN, we want our focus to be as big as God's focus. This means that evangelicals care about abortion and the family, but it also means we care about poverty, injustice, AIDS, slavery, and yes, we care about the environment. Take me, for example. The son of a Bible preacher, I just graduated from a leading evangelical college where I majored in environmental biology. I now travel around the country raising awareness and engaging Christians in my generation with pressing environmental issues. I am an evangelical Christian, and I believe that God calls us to be good stewards of the earth and good neighbors to those we share it with. And there is a growing mass of people out there just like me. Evangelicals may be arriving late, but we are at last joining in the fight to save this planet and the people in it. And we will never give up hope.
And our final guest has always spoken up loudly and directly on behalf of the Earth. David Foreman now directs the Rewilding Institute. Dave?
Only 10 years ago, when the Wildlands Project began to look at the kinds of ecological wounds causing mass extinction, we didn't see global heating as a big enough deal for it to be one of the wounds. Unbelievable levels of extinction were happening because of direct killing, habitat destruction, fragmentation, loss of evolutionary and ecological processes, invasion by exotic species and diseases, and biocide pollution. But now, we know that the greenhouse effect may become the major cause of species extinction in the coming century. This knowledge has locked me back on my heels. It has smacked me in the face like a meteor out of the dark. In some ways, it is too hellish to behold. But it is the real world, muchachos, and we are in it. We need to speak out loud and clear as conservationists that it is the human population explosion that has driven industrialization the last 200 years, thereby causing the greenhouse effect. And as conservationists, we must be loud and clear that the human population explosion and catastrophic global heating will cause mass extinction.
Keeping you informed of the leading voices of the Earth, the weekly Earth Summit is the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Tune in each week on the Wild Side News. Following a short break, we bring you a few items from the news and then investigate what is happening to hundreds of sea creatures along the California coast when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Animal rehab units along California's southern beaches are responding to an unusually high incidence of sick and dying animals. This is not the first time such has occurred, but many feel this year's algal bloom is dramatically different than in years past. In just a moment, we talk with the people who are faced with helping the hundreds and perhaps even thousands of animals in crisis when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. We begin segment two with our nature news brief, then explore what is causing such mayhem to seabirds and mammals along California's southern coast, with three of the people who are on the beaches responding to this unusually severe toxic poisoning of perhaps thousands of seabirds and mammals. So first, the news. The sudden collapse of honeybee colonies that has spread to nearly 30 states is also being observed in nations around the world. In recent months, Taiwanese farmers report that most of their bees are gone missing. Estimates are that over 10 million bees are gone. According to one farmer in northeastern coastal Taiwan who lost 80 of his 200 colonies, they disappeared with no explanation. Disappearance of bees is also occurring in many areas of Europe and in Brazil. Yet another in a series of stories collected in the Global Weirding Archives. Speaking of things disappearing, despite the best efforts of German engineers, the last remaining glacier in Germany is destined to be gone in less than 20 years. Ski and cable car companies, whose livelihood depends on this remnant of years past, pull a massive tarpaulin cover over portions of the glacier during the summer months and collapse uplying snowpacks with explosives during the winter months to concentrate as much snow as possible on the areas used by skiers. But alas, the glacier continues its retreat. It's just another aspect of the global weirding phenomenon that we will be hearing about and learning to live with for many years to come. And finally, wildflower walks, celebrations, and festivals are planned across the nation next weekend, including the Spring Wildflower Day in St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge in Florida. Native Plant Week is a statewide celebration in Idaho. the annual spring wildflower show and plant sale held in Eureka, California. And for more information, Google Spring Wildflowers to find your local celebration. Spring is the time for wildflowers. And that's our Nature News Brief. If you'd like to get on the Wild Side News email list and receive our weekly programming guide, send an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.NET. And be sure to tell your friends and associates about our new weekly Earth Summit that will now air as our first segment of each upcoming edition of the Wild Side News. Do the Earth a favor. Spread the news. Springtime along the coast is a beautiful time in Southern California. The skies are blue and people are taking to the beaches, but there is a new story that's developing on the southern coast of California, which is really quite a tragic story affecting the sea creatures along the coast. To help us understand what's going on, we're talking now with Emily Wing, who's the Director of Marketing and Development for the Pacific Marine Mammal Center in Laguna Beach, California, one of my favorite places. Emily, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
So let's first of all talk about the Pacific Marine Mammal Center in Laguna. Tell us about your mission and what you do.
We are a nonprofit organization with a mission to rescue, rehabilitate, and release sick and injured marine mammals, and also to educate the public about these animals and their environment.
Well, that would put you right in the middle of this story. I would assume that recently you've become very busy in your mission.
We absolutely have. In the past 2 weeks, I would say we have been quite busy. We've seen about 42 animals that have been affected by this domoic acid poisoning that's been happening. It's caused by the toxic algal bloom. And that's in addition to the other, you know, newly weaned sea lion pups, harbor seals, elephant seals that we are rescuing.
Describe what's going on. It's covering quite a bit of the Southern California coastline.
It is. It's actually, there's a harmful algal bloom out there, and the algae blooms. Then what happens is the filter fish, the clams, mussels, that kind of thing, as well as the fin fish, sardines, anchovies, those types of fish, eat this little algae. The algae actually produces something called domoic acid, and the filter fish eat the algae, and then the larger marine mammals, sea lions that we've been seeing in particular, as well as the seabirds, eat the fish, and then the dosage of this domoic acid is concentrated in the fish, and then it actually affects the seabirds and marine mammals. Affects them neurologically.
Amazingly, the fish aren't affected by the domoic acid. For them, it's a regular day, and therefore there's no sort of warning for the animals that would then feed on the fish. But it's quite an extensive variety of animals that are being affected by this domoic acid outbreak. Why don't you describe some of the animals that you're seeing now on the beaches and their condition?
We are seeing right now primarily adult female California sea lions. The domoic acid, it affects them neurologically, and so the symptoms that we see sort of a head-weaving behavior. The animals will kind of point their nose up in the air and just sort of weave their head back and forth. They're often very disoriented. They don't really respond to any sort of stimuli, and it also causes seizure activity. You know, other than that, these animals look very healthy. They're of a good body weight. They've been eating, which, you know, in some ways is essentially their problem. Because at this time of year as well, these female California sea lions are all pregnant. And so they are due to give birth in June and July. And so these animals are eating a lot more at this time of year. And so, you know, ingesting lots of this toxin. So that's one of the other things that makes this story really sad, is that because this damage is not reversible, the levels this year have been so high, we're not just losing one animal, we're losing two. So a lot of the animals we've seen this year have been extremely disoriented, having very violent seizures, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, of the 42 that we've seen in the past couple of weeks, 35 have died.
And that is part of the story, is that it's really killing them off. Many of them are dying. And you're finding, from what the reports are, there are literally dead and dying sea creatures along the coast. And it isn't just the sea lions as well. It's quite a variety of seabirds and other mammals in particular. What other species are you finding affected?
We have seen a couple of dolphins, just from what we hear from the centers up and down the coast. There have been other dolphins affected in terms of marine mammals, and I believe a couple of whales up in the Santa Barbara area, and then definitely the marine birds for sure, the pelicans, grebes, that kind of thing. I know that the center here in Orange County has just been inundated and, you know, with hundreds and maybe even thousands at this point, and we're actually right next door to the animal control facility in Laguna Beach, and I know they've been picking up birds and you know, having reports of dead sea lions and all kinds of things washing up. So
I think it's important to emphasize that this is not going to affect most of the animals in terms of their populations. However, for example, the brown pelican, which is an endangered species,
right,
is particularly hard hit because it is endangered. But in terms of sea lion populations, this is not something that's threatening them. People don't have to worry about that.
No.
However, it is a very unusual dynamic because no one really quite has a handle on why it is that there is such a variability from year to year in the bloom. Some people are suggesting that it almost is as if algae are producing a more concentrated or more toxic form of this domoic acid, but as yet there doesn't seem to be a definitive explanation as to why there is this variability.
No, there is not. And actually, one of the interesting things, you know, that I've read and all the research is that the particular kind of algae that produces this domoic acid, it doesn't always produce it. So there are questions there, too, about, you know, what is it that triggers it to produce the domoic acid? Because there are times that it can bloom and it doesn't produce that. So there are definitely theories out there, but there really are no definitive answers, you know. There are, you know, a lot of people doing research on this, and because it you know, when you see these, the birds and the marine mammals and these things dying, I mean, these guys are sort of the sentinels of our ocean, and it makes you wonder what's happening, why is it happening? Is it just that we're more aware of it now, and so that's why we're seeing it more, or, you know, it is something that's always been there, but why has it been increasing?
It's unusual in the sense that domoic acid was identified as the cause of these die-offs back in the 1990s, although it has been around for eons of time. But for some reason, it appears as if this concentration of the domoic acid in this algae is a unique phenomenon in the last, we'll say, 10 or so years. But again, no correlation between this the periodicity in which the concentration seems to increase. So at this point, we really don't know what's bringing this on. Talk to us about how you respond.
When an animal strands itself, either a member of the public or a lifeguard will give us a call, and then we dispatch a rescue team to go and pick up the animal. And one of the things that we, you know, strongly encourage and sort of want to get the word out is it's important for us to have a good description of the animal, to know exactly where it is, how big it is, all that kind of thing. So we, you know, send out enough people, you know, can respond to it as quickly as possible. And then the other thing that's very important is that we need to encourage the general public not to approach the animal. They are protected under federal law, so there could be a fine for, you know, touching it, harassing it, that kind of thing. And the other thing, too, that's very important is these guys come up to be warm and dry, and so it's very important not to, I think people, you know, sort of thinking about dolphins and whales that always have to be in the water. Sea lions don't. Seals and sea lions do not. They're semi-aquatic, so you definitely don't want to pour water on the animal or try and drag it back into the water, especially with these animals that are suffering from the domoic acid toxicity. If they're having seizures, they can actually, as strange as it sounds, if they have a seizure in the water, they can drown. So to really encourage people to keep their distance and make sure other people keep their distance as well, call the appropriate, you know, authorities. Here you can call us, in San Diego, SeaWorld is responsible for the rehabilitated animals, and or, you know, just let a lifeguard know or a park ranger if you're on a state beach.
We're talking with Emily Wing with the Pacific Marine Mammal Center in Laguna Beach. If people want to find out more about what you folks are doing there, what's the best way for them to find out?
They should visit our website at www.pacificmmc.org. And there's loads of information about the animals, about what we do, how you can help, and I would definitely encourage you, if you're in Laguna Beach, to come on by and visit. We're open every day from 10 to 4, and would welcome, you know, any and all visitors.
Next time I'm in Laguna Beach, I will definitely stop by.
Wonderful.
You got your hands full right now. Hopefully soon things will slow down a bit.
Thank you very much.
Birds have been particularly hard hit. We now head on up the coast to the International Bird Rescue Research Center. This crisis along the coast involving the algae bloom that is creating the domoic acid is really affecting bird species, seabirds. And now to bring us up to date on some of what's happening literally on the beach is Jay Holcomb, who's the director of the International Bird Rescue Research Center in San Pedro, California. Jay, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
What are you seeing?
We've seen domoic acid poisoning before with pelicans, and quite a number of them. And the way we identify them originally is they'll stand on, you know, in little on the beaches, on sandbanks and things, and you can look at the pelicans and see their what we call head weaving. It's almost like they're almost seeming a little drunk. Their heads wave back and forth, and they can't control it, and they actually go into seizures. It's pretty dramatic. So we're starting to see that, but the interesting thing that this year brought was more animals showing up on beaches that were kind of disoriented. I mean, just birds like loons and grebes and some cormorants and a few sea ducks and actually a few shorebirds, you know, little wading birds, that come up and they don't really know what they're doing. They act like they're confused and out of it, and some of them are actually shaking and so on. So we've been collecting those, live and dead, mostly live, and then looking at them and treating them like we treat all domoic acid birds, which is giving them a lot of supportive care, a lot of fluid to help flush the toxin out of their system, and it naturally will get flushed out, but when they are having seizures, they don't eat, so they're dehydrated. And that's what we do to help them.
I mean, this happens on a regularly irregular basis. It's hard to predict. In the past, have you seen these same species involved?
No, we haven't. We've seen pelicans, of course, and last year we had a few birds that we thought may have it, but only a few grebes, and that was it. And that's what surprised us, with people calling saying there's all these birds showing up dead and acting odd on the beaches. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is there's nobody out there really documenting it. I mean, we've got it on some of our video, which is on our website, which is interesting to watch at www.ibrrc.org. The website is great because we have show pelicans with the head waving and a sea lion that's having severe seizures. That'll be on there. And, but there's nobody out there really counting the animals. And our volunteers and a few of our staff, when they can, get out there and capture the live ones they can, report the dead ones, certainly report the pelicans acting odd. And but the unfortunate thing is there's probably more than we even know. And that's just with a few people. So we think it's probably a lot more serious than we even know.
Is it pretty much all along the coast? I mean, you're just finding this as a general situation?
Yeah, good question. Well, actually, the interesting thing is the researchers that do this, that at the Karen Labs at USC, they study they're able to check levels of the algae and things like that out there from Santa Barbara area down to about Newport Beach or that area. And you know, the LA River flows right out of near San Pedro where our center is, and we know that's where water flushes out and so on. So it's kind of the area north and south of that. However, we're getting calls. They're starting to see a lot of dead birds more south than that, all the way down to San Diego. So they haven't been tested yet, but we're working with the rehab groups down there to get samples to see if we can start testing to see if it's down there. So it's typically been, as far as we know, a Southern California event, I think because the water warms up quicker there than it does here. That has something to do with it also.
Now, how long has this been going on, and what's the prognosis into the future here in terms of how long it's hard to know, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
They've only discovered this. It's a natural occurring toxin, but they only really discovered it about 10 to 12 years ago when they, you know, some dogs died and people were being infected by the, you know, eating shellfish. And then after that, what happened was we started seeing the pelicans and so on. So it's really, we've been getting pelicans on a regular, almost every spring. Now we can almost clock it. It seems to be happening around mid-April. And it's been going on for 7 or 8 years now that we've been seeing it. And like I said, nobody's really studied how many birds are being impacted. We only know the ones we capture. And we usually get 50 or 60 or so live ones a year. And people report a lot of dead ones. Our concern is that now it's hitting other birds, other species. We have a lot of loons that were migrating north, beautiful creatures, you know, that some are recovering at the center. Many of them died. And it's stopping them in their tracks. We've had massive die-outs of Western and Clark's grebes, which are another diving bird in the ocean. And no one really knows what it's attributed to, but many of them are coming in with domoic acid also, so we think it could be obviously connected. So our concern is that the domoic acid, the levels of it seem to be rising. This year it's already the highest they've ever recorded, and that Dave Caron has confirmed that at the lab. They're concerned about it. We don't know what it means to the overall health of the ocean. We just know it's increasing, and it seems to impact these animals. And I also wanted to mention it impacts marine mammals, too. They have dead dolphins and seals and a lot of sea lions that have shown up in Southern California that they've tested positive. These animals have severe seizures, so a lot of them don't recover from that.
Since you've been doing this for a number of years, what are you observing as a scientist, as a researcher, in terms of this trend? Does it seem to be following a trend, or is it variable?
It's variable, and you know, and Mr. Caron can probably speak to that better, but what we're seeing is that because the trend is that it's increasing, and that's what we're seeing. It seems to be more regular and more species involved. So, you know, it really, at this point, it poses a lot of questions. I have to be honest with you, because it's so newly studied that no one really knows, but the fact that we're seeing a variety of animals, a bigger variety impacted, and the fact that it seems to be happening a little bit longer and moving around a little bit, like today, they're seeing more dead animals south of San Pedro, and before it was a little bit north, it seems to move around on the currents. And, you know, we all want to think that it's pollution, and it may well be, and that it's global warming, and certainly that could contribute to it, because on Southern California, we have coastal currents that upwell the water and create this really nutrient-rich place, and nitrates that affect it also encourage this algae bloom, and nitrates can come from pollution, but it can also come from natural places, too. And the water we know is getting warmer, and the warmer water creates more algae. So we know those are potential things. We just can't stand up in front of the news and say it's global warming or it's this yet. Right now we don't know, but it's got a lot of it has a lot of alerts in it right now.
Give us a sense of how many birds you're estimating. I realize what you're saying is the numbers aren't all that accurate right now, but what is your sense in terms of the numbers of animals that have been affected so far this year?
Well, we think it's probably in the thousands. You know, I think it's fair to say it probably is. I cannot confirm that. It's not a firm number. We know one of our key volunteers and works with us on oil spill responses is out on the beach in Malibu quite often recently, and she's filmed a lot of birds. So here's an example of what we're seeing. There was a group of 40 pelicans standing on a beach together, like they rest, you know, with the gulls and the other birds. 15 of them had very severe head-waving symptoms. That means they're, and you can see it on the video on the website, their heads are really waving. What that means is that they're experiencing, it's a neurotoxin. Their brains are, they're having, their neurons are firing in their brains, and they're basically having mild seizures. When they do that, they can't do much, and they eventually get weak, and they starve and drown and do all sorts of things. But that's 15 out of 40. Another beach up the road a little bit, they counted 25 out of 40 that were doing the same things. Those are just the severe signs. So we know when it's hitting them mildly, they just get slow and disoriented, and they aren't able to feed and do the things they normally do to stay alive. That's what birds have to do. So looking at that says that there's probably a lot more out there being impacted than what we're actually seeing. So that's what we're seeing, and I think that they're assuming the same things with the seals, but, you know, there's sea lions around all over the place, and they sit out on rocks, and not everybody gets to look at them. I think one of the biggest problems I have right now is there's not, I think this year is becoming serious enough for groups like NOAA and other people to start paying attention, but there hasn't been the level of research and interest towards this that there has in the past. And frankly, part of the reason we made sure it was in the news is because we knew if we didn't tell everybody these animals were being affected, because most of them just go unseen, then no one would pay attention. So we did it so that we'd start to get kind of an alert out there and get the agencies that provide funding and so on to really research this, do that so we can see if it has the potential of affecting people or really impacting larger populations or endangered species. And as you know, brown pelicans are still on the endangered species list, even though their populations have very well recovered, but they're hardly out of the woods. If something like this hits them, then there's a potential of it impacting their population. And one last thing I wanted to say was that almost all the pelicans we receive in at this time of year are what we call breeding adults. They're in adult plumage. They're in breeding plumage. It doesn't mean they have a nest or a chick, but they do nest locally out on the Channel Islands. So if one adult of a breeding pair gets killed or set back from this, then what that means is that their young that they're raising that year or the egg gets lost because one parent can't take care of it. So therefore, you have a potential domino effect. And that's what we want to make sure that ahead of time we're looking at this before it actually hits so bad we don't know what to do.
The thing that occurs to me, and it's obviously occurring to you as well, is that there seems to be a broadening of the effect into new species. And obviously, as you made the point that you go and you see perhaps 25 out of 40, that doesn't mean that the other 15 aren't as well affected.
Right, exactly. You're just not seeing it. And, you know, wild animals don't show you what's wrong with them unless it's really obvious or they can't control their symptoms. Like in this case, when they're having seizures, There's nothing they can do about it. But they hide and they don't do things. So you're probably not seeing them. And pelicans go out and rest on places where there's nobody around because that's where they're safe. So, yeah, I think there's potentially a lot more. And, you know, we never want to be, say, the sky is falling. At the same time, we don't want to be stupid and ignore it. So we're just kind of basically saying, okay, let's just be aware and pay attention. We're going to get these birds. We're going to sample every bird we can. The live birds, we just take a half a cc of blood on. It's not a big deal when we're caring for them because we take blood from them anyways to kind of read their internal health. And then when we can, we do collect some dead animals on the beach, but frankly, we don't have the funding or the staff to do that. So we're trying to get somebody else to really take an interest and do that kind of stuff so we can really know what's going on because we don't want it to affect people too. And we know that domoic acid does have that potential and the health department's on top of it, but you know, I just think being a little bit ahead of the game is being smart.
If people want to find out about your work, tell them how to get a hold of you.
Get a hold of us through our website at IBRRC.org. That stands for International Bird Rescue Research Center and has all the contact information and everything there. And we also, you know, we always need funding. As you know, we're a nonprofit group, and we actually have a great adoption program where you can adopt a pelican and actually go on its release with us, and we give you the band number and you get a certificate. It's pretty great. People love it. So we have all sorts of things to include the public the best we can, at least contribute back to the environment by saving one of these birds, and we got plenty of them around.
We're talking with Jay Holcomb, who's the director of the International Bird Rescue Research Center in San Pedro. Jay, I'm hoping that we'll have another conversation when things have slowed down a bit.
Yeah, call me anytime, and I'll keep you in the loop.
Thanks so much. Reports are coming in that this bloom is different than others. Leading the studies into the specific nature of domoic acid and its role in this event, we now go to the University of Southern California and the Karen Laboratory. We're not going to change our focus and try to really take a look at the science, and there is some good science that's developing around this particular story, and the person who is really involved in this is Professor Dave A. Karen, who is the director and biological oceanographer with the Marine Environmental Biology Group at USC in their Department of Biological Sciences. Dave, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dave, you've been involved in researching this particular toxin. How long have you been involved in the study?
Well, we've been looking at the coastline here for about 5 years for this particular problem.
And what can you tell us that you're discovering about this particular bloom?
Well, this is a seasonal issue. Normally, we find these types of blooms occurring in phytoplankton in general, bloom kind of in the spring, because weather conditions are such that the nutrients become available and the day length increases in spring. So it's kind of the growing season. We have seen these blooms occur about 3 of the last 5 years in significant amounts. But this particular year seems to be a very, very bad one, and I think that's the reason we're seeing all of the birds and animals affected at the beach or along the coastline. This particular bloom, we do a grid of stations that run from near shore to offshore, kind of from Newport Beach up to about the Palos Verdes Peninsula. That's our study area. And we have seen a very intense bloom of the particular type of phytoplankton that produces the neurotoxin domoic acid right along the coastline throughout most of that grid of stations. And in fact, the concentrations of domoic acid in the plankton this year have been about twice as concentrated or twice as great as anything that we have seen anywhere in this study area or actually anywhere recorded for any environment.
I know you're working on the full spectrum of the food chain, that the passing of this toxin along the food chain. Give us a brief summary of that.
Well, we do focus our research per se on the phytoplankton in trying to understand their dynamics, what actually leads to their growth, and in this case, in the production of this specific substance, this neurotoxin. But the food web dynamics for the toxin getting into the food chain are basically any organism that is capable of feeding directly on phytoplankton, on the plankton itself, is really going to be at risk for concentrating this plankton in their guts. So filter feeding mollusks, bivalves, filter feeding fish, anchovies, sardines, these kinds of organisms feed directly on plankton. They put a lot of the toxin and the phytoplankton itself into their stomachs, and then a larger organism, such as a sea lion coming along or a pelican, who feed on those fish, get a large dose of the toxin every time they take in one of those fish. And that's basically the way the toxin itself kind of gets amplified in concentration as you move up through the food web.
So based on the things that I'm hearing and that you're saying as well, the severity of this particular boom is the fact that there is such a high concentration in the algae themselves. Am I right about that?
Well, I think actually, you know, we haven't got the concentration per cell numbers yet. We're actually doing those samples. But in fact, I think what we're looking at is we just have a lot more of that particular alga in the water at this time.
I see.
So the concentrations, the numbers, the abundances of the alga are extremely high, higher than we have seen in the past. And so even if they had the same amount of toxin in them per cell, we're still going to see a lot of toxin in the water.
Are there years that the toxin is literally not produced?
Yes. That is, as well as the, you know, changes in abundances or differences in abundances of the alga itself, there is also the possibility that the alga produces varying amounts of the toxin per algal cell. And we know that domoic acid is not something that is produced continuously. We call it constitutively produced. It actually is produced in response to specific environmental conditions. And we're still, as scientists, we're still trying to understand exactly what those conditions are that stimulate the production of domoic acid. We have some leads on what those things might be, but in fact, environmental conditions will affect the amount of toxin produced per cell.
Well, give us a concept of what may be enticing these creatures to either increase their toxicity or their numbers.
Well, their numbers are based on simply the availability of major nutrients, just like the plants in your garden. Phytoplankton require certain nutrients in specific concentrations. So when you fertilize your garden, if you fertilize your garden with Miracle-Gro, you know, you're putting largely nitrogen and phosphorus, which are the two compounds that the plants really need in large amounts in order to grow, onto the garden. In the case of phytoplankton, in the case of this particular alga that produces domoic acid, one of the suggestions has been that they may lack one of these particular types of nutrients, and people have suggested phosphorus as the element that they may require but they don't have enough of. And some people have suggested that it might be a micronutrient, for example, a specific metal like iron, which is required in order for plants to photosynthesize. If those elements are not present in sufficient supply, it is suggested that perhaps domoic acid is produced either as a mechanism for toxifying other organisms and keeping them from competing for that limiting element, or perhaps it's a chemical agent that can go out and bind up the limiting element like iron and make it available only to the phytoplankton.
Very interesting. We don't really have the answers yet. What do you expect to see in the future here as your research continues, let's say this year?
Well, this year, you know, we're trying to keep up with the bloom. We're trying to document its extent. We are collecting a lot of information that, you know, we won't get a chance to process samples for some of these things for weeks to months. But eventually, as we compare from year to year, we hope to be able to first document whether we're seeing a true increase in the frequency of these blooms, or there is always the possibility that we're simply more aware of them, and that's why we see them. But we're trying to look at frequency. We're trying to look at the magnitude, the actual concentrations of the toxin. And eventually, ultimately, we're trying to understand what are the environmental conditions that lead to this particular alga growing and its production of domoic acid. And I think we'll see more information on that as we go forward.
And typically, how long do these alga produce this toxin in their normal life cycle?
Well, these blooms, the phytoplankton blooms themselves, usually last anywhere from a week to about a month. That's been the norm in the past. So we're hoping that, you know, we'll see the quality of the water turn around pretty quickly here.
We're talking with Dave A. Caron, who's professor at the Marine Environmental Biology Group at USC in the Department of Biological Sciences. We'll keep on top of this, and I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
My pleasure.
Nature makes it obvious to us each day that the balance is fragmenting into uncontrollable and unnatural factors. Many of us do all we can. Many of us wish we could do more. It's time we all commit to restoring health and balance to all of nature's living systems. Thanks for tuning in to our premiere of the Weekly Earth Summit, which you will hear now each Thursday and anytime on the archives. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again, when your voice of the earth calls out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.